These are the Target Files, discussing the novelizations and audiobooks of classic and now also new series Doctor Who stories, looking through the eyes of adulthood at our childhood memories. After all, a great Time Lord once said, "There's no point in being grown up if you can't be childish some of the time."
Hello, welcome to episode 90 of the Target Files, where we are discussing Caves of Androsani, book written by Terence Dix, and new audiobook read by Peter Davison. Hi, this is Alex in Exeter.
And this is Mike in Swansea. Hello.
Final Peter Davison story. I thought it was gave more depth to it. What do you think, Mike?
I think I had issues with this one purely because I love the TV story so much. It's so different in terms of Davison era, in terms of a lot of people say that Peter was never better than in this story, and he plays that manic energy of, you know, racing against time to save Perry very well. And we have Graham Harper being very experimental with his direction, you know, in some of the shots. The use of things like Steadicam, which are, you know, very prevalent nowadays, but were very much in their infancy at the times, you know, single camera shots rather than studio. It's got a very urban, sort of gritty feel to it, and I do feel that Terence Dix struggled to bring it across a bit in the novel, to be honest. You know, it's a little bit A to B from him, and I think it perhaps loses a little bit of tension at times because of that.
I thought, you know, though the action scenes with Terence Dix is normally very good, it just felt a bit lackluster in some bits, I thought, and it does feel like, you know, it's getting to A to B, and I think those sort of bits are really ramped up in the TV episodes, you know, where, you know, Peter does his great, you know, bits when he's on, you know, on the plane and trying to save Perry and that. I just felt a bit lackluster in the sort of, you know, writing of Terence Dix, to be honest. And we know he can do really good battle scenes, and there are some brilliant battle scenes in this on the TV episode, and I just think it felt a little bit watered down, unfortunately, in the book.
Now, I'm not one for ageism in this podcast, but I'm going to make an analogy of it's like not actually watching a film yourself, but like an elderly relative describing the events to you. And, you know, they can't do it with the same sort of panache that we see in a TV show, you know, with the direction, the great direction of Graham Harper, some of the great performances.
Yeah, I would agree. And I'm hoping that with the next Peter Davison Blu-ray box that we get is like they've done with Tom. It's his final season. So we'll get to see this brilliantly in Blu-ray quality, hopefully. And it's like, you know, there's just bits where you really were expecting it to be full-on sort of battle violence, and it just felt really sort of a bit quieter, a bit more reframed, I thought, in the audiobook there.
Yeah, possibly brings forth the Machiavellian aspect of it, but again, I'm going to look at the TV episodes and say they're a bit of a mixture for me of Phantom of the Opera meets David Lynch's Dune.
The Phantom of the Opera in the main sort of villain, and he's sort of, you know, he's deformed and defrayed from sort of an accident what's happened, and his sort of love for Perry and sort of, you know, does everything for Perry by the end, and it's sort of round it, it's sort of this very sandy sort of duney sort of landscapes, isn't it, what looks stunning in the sort of way it's shot on that. And it's sort of, I don't know, I think it's a very basic storyline, but it's actually one of the best Peter Davison episodes, I think, personally.
I mean, I'm thinking of these Phantom of the Opera, perhaps even Frankenstein type monsters in the Doctor Who Target books before. I mean, I'm going to make a comparison to, I think it's the Brain of Morbius book,
where Brain of Morbius is based on Frankenstein.
Yeah, Brain of Morbius, we have the, I can't remember the sort of Frankenstein-esque character's name.
The analogy, I think, definitely with Shahrazjak, is that how you think that's how you pronounce it?
Shahrazjak.
Say it, Mike, your pronunciation is probably better than mine.
Yeah, Shahrazjak.
That's it, Sarah's Jack. And he's sort of very deformed. It's sort of, you know, there's that one shot right at the end where he takes the mask off and you see sort of a very blobby, fired face, really.
Yeah, can you lose a bit from the TV versions when they're translated across like this in terms of that sort of character, that sort of monster with a heart underneath?
Maybe a little bit. I always thought there were some really good bits in this sort of... sort of the TV. So I think that you know, when the, you know, when you see them being at the quite nasty fire, you know, beginning of the cliff angle of the first episode, sort of the fire, you know, where it looks like Perry and Doctor are going to get shot. That's a really nasty bit, I thought.
Yes, and we have a bit of a Machiavellian undertone, don't we? We've got the idea of Spectrox being this much sought after drug on Androzani, machinations, shall we say, of Traumorgus. He's a quite a deep and complex evil character, isn't he?
Yeah, there's some really deep and complex characters in this book, I think. You know, there's a sort of slightly maybe more fleshed out in the actual book than they are on TV. But I think there's a whole politics of this whole thing, you know, what Spectrox is meant to keep you young forever, so you know, people are addicted to it, it's like another drug. And then the irony is, though, if you take too much by accident, it will kill you. So it's got, there's sort of an irony to it, I think.
You know, in terms of certain scenes, I will pick out one scene by Terence Dix, which I think is an improvement in the book. It's when Triumorgus allows the president to fall down the lift shaft. You know, it's a sort of very menacingly done and over with pretty quickly in the performance on TV, but he really does build up the tension in that scene.
Yeah, I would agree. That scene is like takes a good couple of minutes in the audiobook of that sort of build-up until he falls down the lift shaft. In the TV episode, it's like over in a second or two, I think.
Character-wise, we have the mercenaries as well. Is it Stance or one of them is very sort of menacing, isn't he? He's very much the alpha of the group.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think for this time, you know, as for time of Doctor Who, it's a really violent Doctor Who, this one. We have these sort of very nasty mercenaries who are just trying to, you know, make as much money through the spec blocks as possible, and sort of, you know, they want, you know, they want to get as much money from it as possible, and they do anything, and they're sort of, you know, they even kill their own people who are trying to, you know, who are with them. It's sort of, there's that very nasty scene where, you know, he sort of shows how powerful he is, you know, the head of the boss, by nearly killing the other person with the pill. And I thought that was quite a nasty scene.
Yeah, hanging him over the side of the dune. But the way it's shot on TV, it's one of those, shall we say, less threatening looking ledges, like the one that Susan fell over in The Five Doctors.
Yeah, it doesn't look as scary in the theory. It's like a little ledge. You think, oh, well, it won't get hurt. When in the book, it's sort of really ramped up, and you think he's going to be, you know, die from the pill he's nearly swallowed. So I think that book works again better in the book than it does on TV. But I think the TV episodes still have a greater power. I think, you know, they have that sort of menace and sort of maybe decay of the Doctor. I think because he's sort of struggling for the whole of the episodes, really.
Yes, some very brave cliffhangers. You know, the one, episode one, with the machine gunning of what might be the Doctor and Perry, and then episode three with the Doctor seemingly going to crash the spaceship.
Yeah, there's some really good cliffhangers in the episodes, and the way they're shot and work, they work really well. And I think the crashing of the spaceship works better on the TV episode, because I just thought, obviously it's done in one take maybe on that, and Peter Davison gives it all, you know, it's going to crash. And I just thought it was a bit, oh, I'm going to crash, you know, this isn't as important when he was reading the audiobook.
Yes, female character-wise, perhaps quite opposite ends of the scale. Perry is fairly strong at times, but she's very much set up as the damsel in distress.
Oh, most definitely. Unfortunately, with this, it's sort of, you know, she is the damsel. She's the person who gets ill, and it seems to sort of, you know, turn into the love attraction of the villain. And yes, I feel unfortunate, because, you know, Nicola Bryant can be very good as Perry. I just think this one was like not to her greatest strengths, unfortunately.
And then on the opposite side, we have Timon, a lovely bit of Traumorgus says it up as betrayal at the end, but shall we say forward planning from her?
Yeah, maybe. I think she knows exactly what's happening, and she works it, you know, she keeps her on her toes for the whole of the book and the episode. I think she's definitely more of a out. I think there's a very, you know, very bit of an androgynous sort of look to her, way she's sort of made up and that. I think she works really well.
Yes, audiobook Wise Owl, released a few months ago, read by the Fifth Doctor himself, Peter Davison.
Yeah, I think it's a good performance. It sort of, I don't know, his Perry isn't the greatest, but I think other people are good in it, the way he does sort of villain and the other people around it. Sort of mercenaries are very good. He can do a good reading. I just think bits I was expecting to be, you know, really ramped up. Like I said, the bit when he's crashing the spaceship is a bit normal. I didn't think it had as much energy as it did when he did it, you know, many years ago in the actual episodes. But I think I quite like the way, you know, his regeneration bit was good at the end. So I think it's not a bad performance. And there's a good, quite good, strong soundscape in it, I thought.
Yes, I'd certainly agree on the soundscape, Al. And I was also going to mention that scene you did. Very powerful cliffhanger, episode 3 on TV. Of course, he delivers this line quite forcefully in the TV version. You're not going to stop me now from crashing the spaceship. And he does sort of measure it a bit more, but I did feel it worked sort of in the context of the gentler pace of the novel. I felt it, you know, it didn't ramp up the threat like it does visually when you got Graham's fabulous direction on TV, you got the fabulous sound editing. But I felt it was within tone of the novel itself.
Yeah, maybe. I think I just had the actual TV episode performance in my head as well, which is always probably not a good thing to do. But I think, yeah, overall, I think Peter Davison does do a good audio reading, and I hope he's going to do the new Dalek book that's coming out from his in July. I think that would be good if he's going to read that, hopefully.
Yes, I do wonder with the actors when they go back and look at their stories sometimes, you know, 40 odd years ago. Do you think they watch the TV episodes again as a bit of research, or do you think it's better that they go in cold to the text?
I would suspect with Peter Davison, he goes in cold. I bet he goes in cold, just reads it, does the job and goes away again. I expect no Peter. So, Mike, we must talk about the covers for this book and audiobook. What have we got with this time?
Hardcover initially, released the 14th of March, 1985. We have Doctor Who, the red and white trimmed Peter Davison logo. The very caves nice. Of Androzani in white underneath. The swirly effect, I think it's meant to be in relation to the regeneration scene on TV, a swirly sort of look at Peter's face, but it looks a bit like the baby god from the Teletubbies to me at the moment. That's what it reminds me of. Shara is Jack in the gimp mask, shall we say?
I was wondering what you were going to mention. It is a bit like that.
Shall we say the two-toned leather, shall we say?
Yeah, two-toned leather.
White and black, you know, for younger listeners, yes. Don't ask what that means, folks. Okay, number 92 in the corner. Yeah, this was a mix-up on this one, apparently, because 92 and 93 were released in the wrong order, but Planet of Fire...
I thought so, that sounds in the wrong order.
Yes, Planet of Fire was released, or decided to be released late in the day, so that got swapped around. But it still says 92 on this Caves of Androzani cover. Very blue background, very detailed Shara's Jack. Like I said, I can't get the Teletubbies god out of my mind.
Stop it.
But, and recreated well on the most recent audiobook cover, Al. Andrew Skeletor one as well. Doesn't tell you a great deal about the story. You could do with more of a reference to Peter's face in the regeneration. Perhaps you can have the TARDIS on there somewhere, perhaps a bit of regen light.
Have they stuck with the old logo on the new audiobook, or is it the Jodie logo?
Yeah, just double check for you. On the CD release, we have the Chibnall Doctor Who logo.
And it's, what a surprise.
It's a bit wider with the same central image, you know, just more sort of blue in the sky on the wider perspective shot.
Very nice. I think it's a nice image, but it doesn't really tell you anything. This is a really good story. You could have had, like, you know, you could have had one of the bats on him. I think it's a bit of a bland cover, unfortunately. It doesn't really tell you a great deal.
Or the Spectrox dripping down Perry's top. Oh, sorry, no, I shouldn't have said that.
No. We all know that's the famous shot, isn't it, when he regenerates.
Yes, possibly, I don't know, a good thing or a bad thing that you don't see that in the book. But.
Maybe. I think what I did, I found on YouTube the actual regen scene, watch that, and then listen to the regen scene at the end with Peter trying to do Colin's voice and not getting it exactly right, unfortunately.
No, it's a fair enough effort, though, and something Graham Harper refers to in the DVD commentary, that he wanted to base the whole build-up to the regeneration, as when he was planning his notes for directing, he was listening to Sgt. Pepper by the Beatles, and you get the... What's the track? The one that ends at a big crescendo, I've forgotten it.
Oh, A Day in the Life.
A Day in the Life, that's it. He was listening to that at the time. So he thought he wanted to do it this way, and that's why we get all the vision mix and the gradual build-up, the return of the companions, and The Fifth Doctor's last word being Adric, of course, which people have been amused about down the years, but one of his companions that died, of course, so fair enough.
So, scores for this. This is an interesting one because I've always really liked the actual episodes and this being Peter's last story, and I'm really hoping that the next Blu-ray box set after Tom's last story is going to be Peter's last story, so we'll get to see this in beautiful Blu-ray quality. I think it's a good story, including it's based on a very basic idea of, you know, the Doctor turns up on a planet, gets him poisoned, and then has to spend the whole story trying to save Perry, and there's all the sort of politics around it on top. So I do like the story. I thought it was well paced. I think even though the tone sticks is a bit A to B, unfortunately, I think it does have a worth of a listen because Peter Davison's performance is very good. So I think I'd probably still give the actual episode, because of the direction, the TV episode is probably a 9, and I'd probably give the audiobook book an 8.5, I think.
For me, it's going to be a bit of a discrepancy. I absolutely adore the TV version. That's 9.5 heading for a 10 for me. But as I alluded to before, the analogy for me is somebody describing a film to you. Obviously not getting all the details right, and it can become quite laboured at times, a little bit boring. Dix keeps some of the intrigue. So I'm going to say a 7. 7 out of 10 for the audiobook and the novelisation. Peter, you know, does his best. Doesn't add a great deal of flair to it. You know, sometimes the audio performance can elevate our scores a bit, but I'll keep them both at a solid 7.
Well, that's good, because it's a well worth listen, I think. And, you know, Caves of Androsani has always been like people's favourite. I think every year for a long while, DWM always had it as their number one favourite episode. And I can see why that is, because it is a very, you know, it's a very good, perfectly tight story. And I think it works so well. So it's one of those ones that I do go occasionally back to, because it's, you know, Peter Davison at his best, I think.
TV-wise, Al, do you remember this one on broadcast? Are you old enough?
When was it? When was
84, it? I think March 84, something like that. Something
no,
like
I
that.
I would have been free then, because I'm born in 81. But I have seen it. I saw it. That's it. I think it was one of the ones that did get, like, you know, from on BBC Two, continuously sort of repeated in the late early 90s, basically, when I was watching Doctor Who a lot in that sort of period. And it was one I really enjoyed, because that first cliffhanger was like, well, I can't shoot the Doctor. It's like, it was a really good cliffhanger, and it sort of carried on from that. I think, you know, and that bit at the end where he regenerates to save Perry is so good. And then you got, I still think you got one of the best regeneration problem episodes ever going, you know, with when Colin became the Doctor. I still think that's the best regen episode we've had, even though I did like Jodie's recently. I thought Jodie's was very good as well.
Yes, it did occur to me, Al, that this is the first Doctor I remember. The very first episode of Doctor Who I remember seeing is Legopolis, so I saw regeneration to start with. But Peter really was my Doctor at this age. But it occurred to me that I was born in 77, you know, 4 years before you. Your first two Doctors in the TV run, you didn't really get to see regen at all, did you? Baker and McCoy, and I wonder how you sort of felt about that. Eventually you'd see McCoy in the TV movie, and of course he plays Colin with his head turned over, but you don't see a story preceding that in Time of the Rani. How did that make you sort of feel about regeneration?
Well, I didn't really have, it doesn't say, not, you know, I didn't really have a really good regeneration, to be honest, because, you know, Collins is so quickly done into Sylvester's, and that doesn't really work. And then, you know, we didn't have anything till, I think the first actual regeneration I saw worked was the one that doesn't really work, when he becomes Paul McGann's Doctor. And that's why I'm still, to this day, really big Eighth Doctor. I think it was always Sylvester McCoy was my Doctor, but the actual first regeneration I ever saw was McCoy into Paul McGann, which I think really worked. And of course I went back and watched, you know, all the other stuff after that, because I'm an addicted Doctor Who fan. And I watched all the, you know, Tom, I think the next regeneration I ever saw was Tom's into Peter. I think that was the first, next one. Then so weirdly out of order, because where BBC Two used to do it, then Pertwee into Baker and backwards and forth, basically. Well, I think, yeah, definitely the first regen was McCoy into McGann, and I thought that was so well done, because, you know, the way they use sort of opera and all the sort of backstory of, you know, what the people we'd met. The first regen everybody probably is going to talk about now is probably in the new era, when you had Eccleston into Tenor, and that was a really good regen, I thought. And they've made, I think in the new era, they've made regeneration really quite good these days, because it was not quite on the mark, I thought, back in the day. Now it's quite, you know, you got like beautiful gold lighting and all the sort of whooshing and sort of great sound when a Time Lord turns into the next one.
Yes, with the technology nowadays, especially, I'd say, out of the new series batch, definitely Eccleston and Peter into Jodie were probably my favourites.
Yeah, I like those. I also like, I have to admit, I quite enjoyed, when I was watching it earlier, when Jacoby turned into John Sims' master. That was a really good one as well, I thought. So that there's been quite a few good ones in the new season, I think.
Yeah, very menacing one, that, with a little scream.
Yeah, that sort of great scream when he goes, oh, I'm younger. The regens have got better since the new period. Well, because people my age didn't really have one. You had Colin and Sylvester, and that was like, boom, I'm now Sylvester for the whole of that first episode of Time, you know, the Time of the Run. It was, didn't make much sense, to be honest.
This is Alex Gibbons' Doctor Who News Round.
Hello there, this is Alex with Who's News on January the 20th. Right, first thing to mention is the final viewing figures for Resolution, the New Year's Day Doctor Who episode. And it eventually had a fine score of 7.13 million viewers, which includes, obviously, the people watching it like me on air and also all the catch-up and mobile device figures. To fill in your gaps of having no Doctor Who this year, we've also got two new redone and rewritten Target books. We have Resurrection of the Daleks and Revelation of the Daleks. These are written by Eric Savelin and are out in July and November as hardback books, ebooks, and hopefully there are going to be audiobooks as well, but nobody has been announced for the reading of them quite yet. Well, we can probably expect it to be either Peter Davison, Janet Fielding, Colin Baker, and Nicola Bryant, but that's probably my wish list there. From BigFinish.com this week, we have The Diaries of Riversong Season 5, and this is going to be a bit of a corker. It is going to be Alex Kingston back as Riversong with four different versions of the Master. This is Jeffrey Beavers, Sir Derek Jacobi, Eric Roberts, the Paul McGann TV movie Master, and of course, Michelle Gomez, up against the great architecture of Dr. Riversong. We're not too sure how she's going to cope with five different versions of the Master and the Mistress, but I'm sure she'll manage. Also coming soon from BigFinish.com is the Missy box set. Yes, the female version of the Master, played by the fantastic Michelle Gomez, is getting her own four-story box set at BigFinish.com, coming soon in January. Well, of course, we're now on to the great fun of what we've all been watching, me and Mike. I did go to the cinema this week and watched two very different films. I went to see the absolutely stunningly beautiful Colette with Keira Knightley in and Dominic West. Very, very good period film drama about the French writer Colette and how she created basically an industry, a sort of superstar of the 1900s French literary. Then, because it's up for Oscars and BAFTAs, I went straight afterwards to see The Favourite, the big film with Olivia Colman in, Emma Stone, and of course Rachel Weisz, which is meant to be fantastic. It's meant to be the best film of this year. Unfortunately, I didn't think so. It just didn't seem to work in many places, and I'm probably one of the people who doesn't think that, because a lot of critics and that are saying it's brilliant. TV-wise, there's lots of good drama at the moment, being cold in January. There's Les Miserables again with Dominic West in. He's getting everywhere at the moment, which is brilliant. Silent Witness, been watching. What else? I mean, you listen to a lot of music off Apple Music. How about you, Mike? What have you been watching? Of course, Star Trek Discovery is back this week as well, I think. And also on Netflix, I've been watching The Punisher Season 2, which has been very good.
Before I go on, Al, what was it about The Favourite that you didn't like? I've not seen it myself, you know, I've read a lot of the hype, I like all the performers in it.
The problem I will say with The Favourite is three things, really. One, if you like oil. It's like the best way of describing it is it's done in a fish-eyed lens. If you know what that's basically, where it looks very tight and sort of, you know, it looks very weird. Basically,
yes.
Then there was this very sort of weird piece of music halfway through, which I thought was a fire alarm going, so I took my headphones off and it was actually on screen. It's the best way of describing it, is it sounds like a screeching owl gone backwards, basically, and it's meant to build up the tension and the agony he's in, but it just sounded horrible. And then I think because of the way it's set up, it's like every 10 minutes it's sort of made into chapters. It's like there's a chapter heading comes up and it's like different chapters, basically, and I think it just sort of breaks your sort of narrative feel of it. It's sort of meant to sort, you sort of have to restart how you think about it, like every sort of 20 minutes. And I just don't know. It just didn't agree with me. I thought the performances were really good, but I just don't know. It just didn't agree with me, I don't think. Do you think it's worth seeing? Because there's been so much hype about it, so I had to go and see it because of Oscars and that.
Yeah, not being myself to see it, but one of those ones I probably wouldn't go to the cinema anyway. I'd wait for it to be released on streaming, you know, officially.
Yeah, I think it will be soon. I think the way I look at it is I think the performances, yeah, will win, you know, Olivia Colman probably an Oscar. But you know, I have this whole thing is where, you know, and one of our friends on Facebook mentioned Charlie Ross, that why don't you just get a really good disabled actress, you know, who's got the leg problems? Why do you need somebody like Olivia Colman, who has to do like method acting to get into that performance? And it's like, well, because of money, the obvious answer is because of, you know, a big distribution company wouldn't, you know, pick the film up if it was something nobody knew of. But it's like, when there's so many good disabled actresses out there now, why do you need to go down that route?
Yeah, we've seen Doctor Who use people who've had hearing issues in the past, sight issues, you know, persons of restricted growth. We've had those performers before, so why not?
Exactly, and it's like, and it's this whole argument that if you were sort of a young, you know, sort of very good actor in Hollywood who's either, you know, blind, gay, or anything, and then you go to the distributor, because you look at any film these days, I've noticed in a lot of big films now, you have like at the beginning of the film a good 2 minutes of people at the distribution companies now, and it's like four or five distribution companies for one film these days, and it's like, that's the money factor, basically, you know. If you went to a big someone, go, oh, I've got this great actress, and she's, you know, got leg problems, so she'd be great as Queen Anne with her leg problems. And they go, what's he done? This is not, no, we won't get the money. And you say, oh, we can give you Olivia Colman, and she'll get the money and distribution on the spot, basically. That's the problem, unfortunately.
Obviously, you know, the entertainment industry, like many, is never going to be totally fair, but would they just need that representation more?
I think so, and it just maddens me a bit, because I think Olivia Colman does a very, very good job, and I think she will probably win an Oscar for that performance. It is very good, but I cannot see The Favourite winning Best Film, and there's other really good films like Vice and other things. So anyway, what else have you been seeing, Mike? There's me waffling on there.
Well, this week I finished Lucifer Season 3 last night. It was cancelled by, I think, NBC, and it was being picked up by Netflix for Season 4, so really looking forward to that. It should be with us in the next few months. Found a very good, interesting, quirky podcast called Finding Drago. Premise is, if you look at the Wikipedia page for Ivan Drago from Rocky IV, Dolph Lundgren character, it suggests there was a spin-off novel written about the character after the Rocky IV movie, and these two Australian comedians, presenters, have decided to investigate this, and I can't spoil it for you, but if you listen to Finding Drago, it's a very amusing podcast. It's a very investigative look at what can happen with so-called fan fiction nowadays, but a very quirky one, very well recommended. And I also wanted to mention, Al, just a general post on Gallifrey Base this week. Now, there could be absolutely nothing in this. It could just be...
I bet you've seen the same one I've seen. Well, go ahead. I bet it's to do with the distribution.
No, it's not that. It's to do probably with a lull period of Doctor Who, so it could just be a bit of a hype put in by somebody. But one poster suggested that we may be seeing another Doctor Who and the Daleks film at some point. So that would be very interesting, and it got the brain cells going, wondering how they'd do it. Would it be sort of the human scientist, Peter Cushing type character? It got me thinking who you'd cast nowadays in those roles, Al. You know, if it had to be someone separate from Jodie on TV, what sort of big names would you think about casting, you know, female or male?
That's a difficult one, because there's so... I have to say, at the moment, because I love his performance at the moment, I think he can do so much. I might put Dominic West as the Doctor if I was going male, or if I was going completely out of the left field, probably Idris Elba would be fun as the Doctor, maybe. Or female-wise, I'd say maybe, I can't remember the name, the person who's in Killing Eve, who's really good, and maybe Gillian Anderson. Those would be my sort of ideas.
Yeah, I think female-wise for me, Eva Green would be a possibility.
Oh, yeah, she'd be good. She'd be good.
Hayley Atwell, I think.
Samuel Woe, isn't it? Samuel Woe. Is that the one who's in Killing Eve?
Yes. Sandra Oh. Yeah.
That's
Oh, Jodie Comer is the other one.
Yes, yeah, it's the one who plays the assassin, isn't it? That's Sandra Oh, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. But quite a few options, I think, female-wise. Possibly Ruth Wilson from Luther.
Oh, yeah, she'd be good, because he's just... Whenever she gets in that sort of psycho mode sort of person, he can bring out so... He does comedy quite well as well, I think, Ruth Wilson does.
And it must be about 2 years ago now since we found out Capaldi was leaving, and I think we recorded an episode with our thoughts then, and I was going to suggest Charlie Chaplin's granddaughter, Runa, and I think she'd be a good shout.
She is brilliant. That would be good, because he can do comedy as well as accents. We saw with the first season of The Taboo, which he was brilliant in, and I think that sounds a possibility. The thing I was on about is that I thought I heard a rumour that... after 2020, BBC had lost the main rights to showing Doctor Who.
That one has been called out straight away from a Twitter account that had recently been set up just to tweet that. And
so
the way it was worded was Doctor Who has decided to give up the rights. No, it wouldn't do that. Owns all the rights. It would sell them. And what's more likely to happen at one day, you know, I'm just speculating myself here, is that it'll go into joint production with a Netflix, with an Amazon, you know, at some point for international rights, just to get that extra bit of boost of cash.
Well, I think that will happen, because everything BBC-wise in America is a joint deal with Netflix these days. So I think the new Dracula thing, what Stephen Moffat is doing, is a joint deal with Netflix, basically, and that's done by the BBC. And a lot of stuff recently, the Watch It Down we had at Christmas was joint with Netflix, so... That seems to be the way BBC go when it comes to doing the world sort of distribution of their stuff now.
And I just wanted to return to that Doctor Who and the Daleks movie rumour. Say, I'd put forward someone like Tom Ellis, who was great in Lucifer. Of course, he played Martha Jones's boyfriend in Last of the Time Lords. So we'd have that sort of link, as we had with Bernard Cribbins with the old Dalek movies coming into the TV series. But Tom plays Lucifer in a very sort of almost darker Doctor-like way. A bit of Doctor, a bit of the Master in there. Actually quite camp at times, a little bit like Rick Mayall in some of his reactions.
Well, that would be good. I think it'd be good. On a sort of Doctor Who note, I am looking forward to Good Omens hitting Amazon Prime, hopefully at some point this month. That does look very good.
Yes, and it apparently won't be on BBC until the autumn. It'll be obviously Amazon Prime exclusive for 6 months.
Yeah, that's why I'm hoping we don't have the normal Amazon Prime audio description problems, I like to call it. I'm hoping they bung it on straight with audio description, because it looks so good, that does. Have you started watching Star Trek Discovery yet?
No, I'm going to do episode one of season two tonight.
You got to do that because they've gone back to the captain from Enterprise, haven't they?
Captain Pike is in it, and we know that Spock was recast to be later on in the season as the spoiler, folks. If you haven't seen it, brother of Michael Burnham, the character.
It's just the only thing that annoys me is why you can't binge watch it, unfortunately, can you? Because it's done week by week on Netflix with the Star Trek Discovery. So that's my annoyance with it. So I should probably wait till the whole first chunk is there and watch it as one, probably.
But going back, Al, to when you mentioned Good Omens, written by Neil Gaiman, of course. The last episode of Season 3, Lucifer, when I feel they felt they thought they were going to be cancelled outright, we actually have narration from God himself, and God's voice is Neil Gaiman, so that's a very enjoyable episode.
Really? Because he gets everywhere. Neil Gaiman gets everywhere, which is great, because his stuff is brilliant.
It took me a minute to work out who the voice of God was, and then it sort of clicked when it comes up and says on the credits, created from an idea by Neil Gaiman and other people.
Because that was one of the good things at Christmas, having Norse mythology on Radio 4, and that was really good. That's well worth a listen. I think that's coming out on Audible soon. But
as you mentioned, Watership Down, I did catch up with that, and yes, I did enjoy it. I know people complained about the slightly computer game type graphics, but I soon got over that because the voice performances were so wonderful, with an excellent cast. You know, really matching the one from 1978.
I still haven't watched the second part. I watched the first part of Christmas. I didn't get round, so I've got my box. I need to watch both parts. It's like, Yeah, I enjoyed it, but I just think no. I thought the animation was a bit too graphic. I think it was good performances from all the sort of voice people. What I don't know. I need to watch. I think the problem was I need to watch it as one whole thing instead of two parts. I think.
Yes, Al, and next time's Target Files, we'll be doing a bit of a special episode. Details coming up shortly.
Most definitely. It'll be one worth downloading and listening to.
Next time, Doctor Who Target Files. We'll be discussing, in a special episode, Doctor Who versus Scratchman. Written and audiobook read by Tom Baker. You can contact Doctor Who Target Files on Twitter at DW Target Files, leave a message on our Facebook page, and please do rate and review us on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening. Doctor Who Target Files, The Caves of Androzani review, featured Alexander Gibbons and Michael Winks. 13th Doctor theme composed originally by Sagan Akinola. Version for the podcast by Borna Matosic. That's BORNAMATOSIC. Check out their YouTube channel. Newsround, opening and closing themes, composed originally by Ted Heath and his orchestra and by John Baker. Doctor Who Target Files, The Caves of Androzani review, was recorded in Exeter, Devon, England and Swansea, Wales, UK during January 2019.